Hi, this is Terry Stewart, CEO of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, Ohio. And you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on one of my favorite shows, the Harmony Street Show.
This is Mike Miller, and you're here with me on the Harmony Street Show, and it's my pleasure to have as my guest, producer, arranger, vocalist, guitar virtuoso, and a guy that I've respected musically for so many years, Mr. Johnny Gale. How you doing, John?
I'm doing very good, Mike. It's my pleasure to be here with you.
Yeah, that's great. Now, I hear it's very cold in Long Island right now.
I'm wearing mittens as we speak.
If anybody can play finger style with mittens, you can.
Thank you. Well, I don't know about that, but okay.
You were born where, Johnny?
In Flushing, Queens.
Wow. Do you know, I lived in Flushing for a long time. I was in right off of 193rd Street and Francis Lewis Boulevard, like in the Auburndale section for a while.
Sure. You know, no, I was born in Flushing Hospital, so I was further west, you know, down by Main Street, I guess, by R.K. O'Keefe's, where that used to be.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it's all good. Did you have a musical family growing up?
I did. My uncle was in the New York Philharmonic from 56 to 76, and
wow.
He was with the NBC Orchestra with Toscanini. The first viola was my father, was an accomplished pianist. He was an architect by trade, but he was an
wow.
accomplished pianist. And my mother's more phenomenal than anybody. She was an incredible singer and musical talent.
Wow. Okay, so in other words, it wasn't like all of a sudden you started listening to the radio and you came into the living room and sang a song. It was almost expected from you.
Well, yeah, the only thing was that the music that I fancied was maybe not their cup of tea. Although I did listen to a lot of WNWAM with my mother, so, you know, growing up and hearing you know, William B. Williams
and
you know, Patti Page and Perry Como and the pop records of the time, you know. My father was a, you know, WQXR guy and, uh-huh. and was strictly classical, you know. So,
right.
And I love it now. I listen to Rachmaninoff now. I really enjoy it and see where a lot of the great songs, you know, were kind of derived from. But when I was a kid, I think maybe... especially when I was a teenager, I guess to be with that, I was a little more rebellious, maybe.
Right. Well, you know, I can remember my parents every Sunday driving up the Taconic or driving up the Sawmill, because every Sunday they went house hunting, even though we had a nice house. That's what they did. That was their hobby. You know, they'd go and they'd look at different areas. And I remember driving up with my brother, and I was probably, we were like 5 and 3. And
mm-hmm.
I remember not really liking what my father was listening to. And when I was little, they threw a little Motorola transistor in my little bed that I had. And I remember at an early age finding all the R&B stations, you know,
mm-hmm.
WNJR and WWRL. And I grew up knowing all the lyrics to all the Harptones tunes and the Nutmegs and the Heartbeats. And I don't know how it got there, but it did. It's crazy.
You know, I never was lyrical, you know, so to me they were just sounds, and so I would learn songs phonetically.
Ah.
And when I was little, like that age, and I remember singing that would go on rides on the weekend, and the only way they could get me to kind of settle down was to put on what I used to call wild music, and it was, you know, WMCA and 10-10 Winds and MGM I would entertain them. And I saw I get a rise out of them by, you know, but it was all, you know, phonetics and a lot of them, like, you get a job, you know, still a little bit to, like, kind of crack the code on, you know, what he's actually saying on that. I don't know,
right.
We all know now, but, you
know. Right. No, I hear you. Absolutely. You know, it was funny because, you know, like, the Kalin twins didn't do it for me, man. I needed to hear, I was drawn to the harmonies and, you know, and it's never left, you know, it's in there for good. So, you know, it's all good.
I on the other hand, loved, you know, when loved that record. And, I had actually a friend of mine when we moved from Flushing to Bayside, his mom said to me, we were about 10. She said, Steve tells me you're into music. So she gave me a Decca LP that was kind of in funky condition, no cover, and it was like a compilation record of their, records from 1958. So Domenico Modugno was on there, and Earl Grant, and the Carolyn Twins, you know. So, and I remember, like, I knew it. I never had the record, and I got it, like, in 62. And you know, I just, there's something magical on a lot of those records, otherworldly and vivid, that when I was a kid, I would hear them, they'd come on the radio, and it would be, I might as well have been tuning into Mars, and getting a transmission from Mars.
It lights you up. There were those tunes. I guess that's why they call them hit tunes, because, I combed the Brill Building years ago, and I had, Joe Kolsky was very nice to me. He gave me the nicest dismissal letters, we loved it, but it's not for us and whatever. And, and then I realized, they only listen to the first 10 seconds. If you don't catch them there, you're gone. So, I said, wait, listen to the hook. No, I don't have time. Goodbye.
I guess if they didn't hear right out of the box, and then, they would move on to the next thing.
But it's all subjective too. I mean, we can name all the artists that, they got thrown out of a lot of good places, but they were persistent, and one record company believed in them, and all of a sudden they flew, when did you get your first guitar?
I had a cousin 10 years older than me. Actually, I still do. He's still around. Uh-huh. He gave me a nylon string guitar when I was about 9.
Right.
And I learned some campfire chords on it, and there was a woman that my mother hooked me up with that lived a few blocks away. She was into folk music, and I remember when I learned a couple of chords, I taught her "I Walk the Line" by Johnny Cash, and she didn't know the song,
Wow.
And here I am, 9-year-old kid, of course I only knew it in one key. I didn't do the modulations like that. I was so inundated with me. I have such vivid recollections of every season, every batch of songs. I hear one, and then I remember 10 or 20 from that moment in time. They were unreal or something. And especially when you're very young, it's maybe perhaps even a little more magical than when you're older. But when I was a teenager, I remember my father was a hi-fi buff.
Right.
And I had a speaker mounted on my wall, and then he wasn't easy, got a new system, so I took his woofer that he had from the 50s. He built all his stuff in late 1954. He had a Heathkit preamp, and I brought the woofer upstairs. I put it on one side. I had the tweeter hanging on the wall on the other, and I had an EP with You Cheated by the Shields.
Wow.
And I would pace back and forth to the room because I would be so excited. And I would always sing along with Jesse Belvin, or I would sing with the Teen Queens. I would add a third part. It would make me feel like there was a lot of music that was kind of depressive in nature, that I would turn me inside out. And then there was other music that was stimulated and made me want to go out and beat somebody up. So I'm the gamut,
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because you said you would add a part. So you were already producing and arranging, then. I mean, that's really where it started. If you were adding and embellishing, sitting in the room, then, you were arranging, man. That was it.
When I was a teenager, I really became aware that there were these guys called arrangers. And, of course, without the internet in those days, it was harder to find. I always wanted to know how they made records and who made them. And then I knew they were adults and that they were savvy guys.
Right.
And then, when I did research, and now there's more access to guys that were I couldn't access. I know a lot of people in show business, and I'd ask somebody if they knew Wayne Shanklin, say. And, he was a pretty successful guy, West Coast. Nobody knew, but now if you go on the internet, you can see, they have something on him, some biographical thing on him. But I loved the extreme arrangement on Raindrops, Steve Cork, and found out recently, maybe 5 years ago, there was this guy, Riley Hampton, who was a great string arranger that worked at a Record Row in Chicago. And Johnny Pate was a hot horn arranger. He did all the Impressions records and Major Lance. So a lot of the guitar stuff I do are just from maybe horn charts that that I was able to integrate into an arrangement that I would be doing with an artist I work with or a group, and it would make it sound. They didn't know why, you know, they were getting excited, but some arrangement parts, for lack of a better word,
right.
You know, they kind of always worked at doing what they're supposed to do, which is to evoke emotions and so I learned music that way. I never really had any formal training, but I learned, like, drop two chords from horn charts, like Johnny Pate charts, and I loved the pop arrangers. Guys that were like, you know, we like total squares, but like Leroy Holmes, he did Tommy Edwards records, and they did instrumental adult-oriented pop records, and he did Powers. I ran all the way home. He arranged the album, which was a pretty different kind of arranging for rock and roll at the time, you know. And Don Costa, you know,
did
work with him.
Absolutely.
So they were just, of course, they were grown-ups, you know, and they came from another civilization, and there was something in their sensibility that connected with me so strongly that I give it to people through making records, I hope, you know, if I have some pleasure points in the record.
Right.
And maybe if I play the guitar, I can do something maybe pianistic on the guitar that is something reminiscent of their arranging, you know?
Right, I see what you mean. And, you know, the other thing about some of these names is they're just coming to the forefront now. I mean, you know, people are saying, wow, Jimmy Wright, he played all those sax solos on all those records, you know, for the Solitaires and for you know, so many groups. And his sax solos became very distinctive, or, you know, but we need to know about those names, because really we need to know who put that stuff together, because, you know,
it's been my quest since I'm, you know, I was 10 years old. Before that, I just, you know, would love it, and I would soak it up, and I would record would, like, you know, evoke different feelings, but then, you know, when I started to, you know, become aware that a Roy Orbison record was different than Paragon Meet the Jesters, or something, like, you know, Hispanic landscape wise, I wanted to find out, you know, how they made the records and who made them, you know. So I Googled, a couple of years ago, to get biographical information on Jimmy Wright. It said born in 1927.
Right.
And I said, can't be, because the guy's sensibility, I said, you know, so then on YouTube I see, like, his grandson or somebody in the family wrote in that was incorrect and that the guy was born in 1907. I knew, like, you know, so it's just my instincts for that are pretty strong, because the guy had a different sensibility. It was almost sounding like the music that we met from cartoons that we grew up with, the little mice that looked like bears, you know.
Right, right.
And I remember my father, I was playing Love is a Clown, I had the Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers LP. And for some reason it would irritate my friend when he'd hear a sax solo. It was such an old sound, you know, and I loved it, and my mother loved it. She loved, like, swing music and, you know, big band era, you know, so.
Right.
It's just, you know, such a rich heritage, and there's so much I could talk to you about for 50 years, Mike.
No, I understand. And, you know, what's funny is that, you know, I want to make you aware of the fact that most people, when they listen to a record, they listen to the whole thing and they hear it like kind of as a whole entity. And those right. people that can listen inside the tracks and hear, yeah. you know, what's going on and hear the different vocal parts and hear when the horns are coming in tasty places, those people are very blessed. I happen to be one of them as well. And, yeah. you know, but, and, you know, I listen totally differently. I'll say to my wife in the car, who is a real R&B and doo-wop aficionado, I'll say, did you hear how, what the harmony's doing? Or did you hear, you know, and she'll go, what are you talking about? And I'll say, well, you know, listen again, listen when it comes around.
It's a homogenized thing, or they'll just listen to the guy singing. But, you know, when you do, you know, what I do, you know, for a living, it's about, you know, it's just I had the thirst to deconstruct every arrangement. I had a million records, you know, and
wow.
I would, before, you know, I could do it, you know, in the digital technology, it was, you know, slowing down records, it was doing whatever, and also listening to all those cracks and pops that I could hear. If I put on Blue Moon by the Marseillaise,
right.
I'd want to hear like some muted guitar part or what a guy was playing on a kick bass and what the guy was playing on the upright.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter like what bag it was. If it was, you know, genuinely, compelling, then, you know, I wasn't that discerning. You know, I loved it all. I would, you know, from Patty Page to Jimmy Page.
Right,
you know,
right. Yeah, good music is good music. I've always said that. Yeah. I don't care, you know, what it, I hear, I mean, you know, some of the reggae stuff used to blow my head off and some of the, yeah, I mean, yeah. all good things. I was a very lucky guy in that I hung out at Media Sound. I hung out with Richie Calandra for a while, you know, at Secret Sound. I hung out with Alan yeah. Raymer at Soundworks and I was a fly on the wall and I heard a lot of good stuff go down and, you know, I learned a lot. I learned a lot of good bits and pieces that I could use, you know, take home and use in my little home studio, but never, you know, never got to the level of some other people. I will tell you this, though. One of the things that always intrigued me, and even if you go throughout the 50s and the late 50s, was
right.
all the different ways and all the different places that they would put a lead vocal. You know, that
right.
always intrigued me because like every record is different and, you know, right. it's different for every record. There's, you know, you have a formula, but it's not, the formula is not always good for that particular record.
Are you talking about like the sonic, you know, quality of it or like, you know, the way that the vocal is recorded? Or?
Yes, 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 and yes. In other words, how did
each... And there's the magic of like, you know, late 50s, early 60s, recording for me, you know, when I was able to, I guess, evaluate it, was, the ambience, the room ambience on the records, and I got in the studio in 1968. I was like discovered like as a like a prodigy by a guy named Jerry Samuels.
Uh-huh.
He was known as Napoleon the 14th. He did "They're Coming to Take Me Away."
I remember him.
He also wrote "The Shelter of Your Arms" for Sammy Davis Jr. So he was a pretty serious composer, a wild guy. You know, he was 15 years older than me, so. It was a trip, and he brought me in the studio. And at that time, they were doing very close mic recordings, and with, you know, 26 mics on the drums, and everything gobo'd off and muffled.
Right.
And I would sit there, and I couldn't, because I was a kid, couldn't tell him that, you know, that I felt that it was wrong. And then I would hear playback, and it didn't sound good to me. I remember one time he invited me to see. Yeah, the Tonight Show band, Tommy Newsom was the leader.
Yeah, I remember.
He had Bucky Pizzarelli, George Barnes, and Tony Mottola, those three guys, Ed Shaughnessy playing drums, and they were doing jingles with Associated Studios. And, you know, I watched these guys just in there. There was a day at work for them. And it was awesome seeing them do that because they were, you know, could read and play just great. And but the way they recorded then was just like no air in the sound. We did a remake of a Locomotion. We had Buddy Lucas playing sax. They were doing jingles, and it was the Tonight Show band.
That's
Tommy Newsom was the leader, and
right.
And Bucky Pizzarelli, George Barnes, and Tony Mottola were playing guitars, a formidable guitar section, and Ed Shaughnessy on drums. And it was, you know, exciting seeing these guys work because they were, you know, grown-ups and they really could read and play. But I wasn't really thrilled with the way they made did recording in those days. But it gave the engineer, the producer, much more control with isolation and that dead sound. But
right.
In the 50s and 60s, early 60s, it was about the studios that had great ambience and had what they call great leakage were the places that were successful and everybody wanted to record.
Right.
I remember reading about Sam Phillips that when he opened his new operation after like he had, you know, made it big, and that they never could capture like a acceptable sound in that room. He had a great engineer working for him, and they just never had the magic. I mean, they did have Willie Bully came out of there, and I think Charlie Rich, Lonely Weekends came out of there. Like,
right.
You know, as far as, you know, like pop hits, but. And even Capitol opened the tower. I know for a time in the beginning that some of the big artists didn't want to record there because they weren't digging the echo in the
right.
Studio. That something was not right. And I guess they eventually worked out the kinks, and that was Capitol, you know.
Right.
But the records, they probably recorded the four preps there, and I certainly didn't have a problem with those records when I was a kid. You
right.
know, but. But that maybe Nat King Cole or Sinatra, were more fussy, I guess, or maybe a little more sophisticated at that time.
Yeah, well, you know, let me ask you this. Did you ever record at Media?
I did, and I recorded at Media, but it was like in that era where everything where it was like just dead sounds. The highlight was I met Clyde Otis there,
uh-huh.
who was one of my idols, and I got a chance to talk to him. I also met Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, which is pretty wild.
What's funny is that I was very friendly with one of the staff engineers there, and he actually lived in my house after he separated from his wife.
Yeah.
And so I was there. I got to hang out there much more than I deserved to, and I watched everybody record from Blondie to the Stylistics. I watched Stuff record there in the lounge, which was a thrill, you know, to see Eric Gale and Richard T, Steve Gadd and all those guys, you know, and they would just come in and they would just play, man, and they would just like sit down and play, and they would run the tape recorder. I mean, that was it, you know.
Yeah, well, those guys were the top dogs at that moment, you know.
And the Breckers would hang around there at that point. So, you know, I hung around with most of those guys, and really, who was I? But, you know, I was glad to be there. I watched Frankie Valli. I watched Charlie Colello at 4 o'clock in the morning recording Frankie Valli. He was singing You're a Native New Yorker. And Charlie was pissed at him because he didn't like what was going on and whatever. And finally they pulled a tune from him and they gave it to the group Odyssey, and they had a hit with it. Like they were playing it on WKTU. Like
right.
the, like
no,
the
that
following
was a huge record. I happen to have a Frankie Valli version.
Yeah, right. And they did put Frankie's version out, but I remember Charlie was pissed at him and yelling. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning, and he's going,
yeah.
Nope, take it again. It's not, you know. And the Odyssey group did a great job on that tune, and it came out real fast. And Paco was playing it like the following week. You know,
it was right in that era that I was, you know, doing recording at Media Sound. We had a manager that put us there with an engineer named Bobby Halsall, and we sounded, everything to me sounded like, you know, Bachman Turner Overdrive,
yeah.
Rock, and I just, you know, I couldn't get with it, you know.
Yeah.
I wanted to hear a more ambient sound and you know, just something that was a little more incendiary or that you know, they could get artificially with some outboard gear, but you know, years later, right, when I got to produce on my own, I did a lot of experimenting with it and depending on, I had a couple of rooms that were fantastic, you know, for room ambience, and then some that were huge that
right.
had no room ambience.
Right.
Tried all different kinds of miking techniques and would play a drum, like, you know, one drum at a time. Now we have, like, this digital technology, You know, when I produced a couple of records for Little Isidore and the Inquisitors,
right.
I was partners with David Foreman, and we wrote together, and I made records, and some of them were done like in kind of uncivilized ways, like working all night in a jingle house that he had a relationship with, and they would let us work there all night. But in spite of it, you know, some of them have, I guess, their own charm. Sit there, like by myself, and I don't have to go out and play a four-tom muffling with my arm with a mallet, and it's, you know, it's so it's easier in a sense. It was fun then, you know, discovering, you know, like, or rediscovering or recreating sounds that I had in my head that, if we were doing a cover of, like, you know, Hollywood Flames, you know, Buzz, 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 I would try to, I was just going by the sounds that I carry around in my head from those records, you know, or just trying to, and any little hook, like, you know, musical hook that's something that's familiar to people,
right,
you know, where to try to get a parlay going of as many of those, like, you know, stringing them along. And you know, some records were more successful for me than others.
Been around forever.
Been around forever.
Yep.
And we went in with him. He needed bumpers for a show he was doing called the Harlem Hit Parade. So we went in and we did about 26 bumpers. It was whoever we could grab that was available on this blizzard in this studio in Orange, New Jersey that had a great sound. And David and I wrote Harlem Hit Parade that Angel Rissoff, a.k.a. Little Leopold,
right,
sang in the car on the way there.
The blues is solemn. Everybody dancing and hooting and a hollering. Turn it up, darling. Harlem Hit Parade. Get up, baby. Harlem Hit Parade. Drive me crazy. Harlem Hit Parade. waiting out in the rain to see JB get on his night train. Turn it up, darling, holler me at parade. Yeah, they're jumping up in Harlem, come from near far. I hang ballad at a James Gold needle in a square guitar. A Sam Cooke, Benny King, a Solomon Burke.
In one night, it was unbelievable. It was like, you know, 1956, you know, and it was like a Bill Doggett session where we were just like, Henry Glover's there, and we went in and we cut, you know, a whole record, and it ended up that that song became very popular. We bundled into the beach music scene because of that song, and I'd heard of it, but I didn't really know much about it, and they embraced that record, and it's still today, you know, like a big record in their repertoire, you know?
Well, you know, what's really funny is that some of the stuff that you did, you know, with the Inquisitors, that stuff will never get enough attention, man. That was, you know, all of that stuff was just, like, so well-produced and really, you know, hey, it was a great group, the Inquisitors.
We had a great live show, and I had the studio thing. I mean, you know, whatever I could do, I did. It was, you know, like I said, a little uncivilized sometimes, but we, you know, it exists. So, I remember I loved the flip side of Heartaches by the Marcells. So I you know, turned some people onto that. And I said, we got to make that record. Just, it was a kind of record that maybe the Marcells, like Stu Phillips was maybe a few takes away from having like a little masterpiece with that, but
right.
So we, you know, I made that record and it got spun off on a Rhino box set of you know, doo-wop,
right.
You know, whatever, I forgot what it was called, but
right.
they liked that one, and it, you know, it's a good one, you know.
I love you. He's a bird by said, glow, 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 glow. And each heartbeat keeps feeling with a great desire. So, every time.
I mean, it kind of trivializes the music that we used to call rock and roll.
Well, look, Speedo hated the term. You know, Jimmy Keys from the Chords, when I was a dean in the Bronx for 30 years, I had his kids, and I spoke to Jimmy like once a week. He was in my office because his kids were not great kids. And, he always used to tell me, man, we never sang a note of doo-wop, man. We sang jazz and R&B, and that's it. Forget it. Enough said.
I know. Years ago, I worked with a guy who was, he did occasional leads, but I think he was like a second tenor in Jordan and the Fascinations. Lou Odessa. And, he had an incredible record collection. He was 13 years older than me, so I had a lot of stuff. And when you were a kid, I would play my records. You know, I'd do a million reps with four quarters on the needle and digging the needle in to play Mountain of Love by Harold Dorman. He actually was very organized, and he had the Moonglows in an album, the Harp Tones, the Flamingos, and it was awesome, you know, like seeing, be able to hear those records like in mint condition, and he was very knowledgeable. You know, of course, he really was, grew up and was like a young adult in those years, you know.
Well, you know,
I have an unusual autobiographical memory, so I was the only like 15-year-old in the 60s pining for 10 years before. And I had a drummer that I used to play with, and guy came over to my house one day, and I had my record player out. And I remember I was playing Ship of Love by the Nutmegs, and he came in and he looked at me and he said, "You're sick." And I was embarrassed, you know. And I mean, later on, he went to figure out that maybe I was onto something. But you know, he wanted to be like the Yardbirds or you know, whatever. And I dug that stuff too. I mean, if it was blues derived, I was with it. You know, Eric Clapton, the blues rock, Jeff Beck, and I loved it too. If it was good, I loved it. You know, but there was just something about those records. I remember I had the Flamingo Serenade, and my parents would go out. I had a Fender Super Reverb and a Barney Kessel at the time. Like, this was, I guess, 1967, 68.
Right.
And I put the amp on the tilt-back legs, and I would put on the Flamingos album, and I would turn the reverb on the amp up really high, and I would just, you know, play all those guitar parts, those Terry Johnson guitar parts.
Yeah, you bet. Terry Johnson guitar parts.
And I just, you know, I would get inside, I would be part of the record as I would, like, singing with anything. If it was a duet, you know, like Jesse Belvin, Robert and Johnny, even, you know, female groups, I would always just naturally had, I guess, an ear for harmony. And then when I learned music later, to be able to do more intricate harmony that was, like, counterintuitive and wasn't all parallel harmony, you know, so... But it's just been an incredible, rich experience of working with who I work with. Had an incredible a scene with Kenny Vance, and what we cultivated was unbelievable. You know, and over many years, you know, I knew Kenny from Jane and the Americans. I was with Randy and the Rainbows at the time back in 71.
Right.
Hi, this is Kenny Vance from Kenny Vance and the Planetones, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
And we used to play Community Gardens and Mr. Colossus and the Action House and the Hunkamunka.
Right.
And those clubs, and they were older, so I was actually friends with the guitar player Marty Coopersmith. He was more, I guess, like, was interested. He heard something in me that, you know, sparked an interest.
Right.
But, then years later, you know, we would have involvements on and off, and then I got, you know, became a member of the group in 2001 and as musical director, and you know, obviously Kenny knows a lot about the history of, you know, interesting, you know, stuff about the music business in the 60s and the Brill Building and all the people that he had known and met.
Right. Well, you know, what's funny...
No, we'd have a ball. We'd have a ball just talking about this stuff for hours, and I would tell him, just my experiences or what I would hear, and then I would describe it. And I did, you know, with David Foreman I made a couple of records for Angel Rissoff, and he's also a huge fan of the music. They're just huge fans, you know, and both started as that, and... And, you know, and I think will always be, you know?
You know, one of the things that I'm trying to do, actually, John, in this interview, is that I'm trying to pull you out of your shell, because you don't sound very excited about this wonderful career that you've had. So, you know,
right.
I need you to have a little more enthusiasm. No, I'm just teasing you. I'm breaking your chops because I'm really getting off on the fact that you are just lit up like a candle.
And I was going to say, you know, if I wasn't so heavily sedated, I probably would be more like from Spinal Tap.
You know, like, no, I'm teasing, Johnny.
You know, and we would watch the Patty Page show or Perry Como or Sunday nights at Sullivan. I see the Kirby Stone Four doing Bubbles, Bangles, and Beads.
Right.
And you know, Johnny Paleo and it left such an impression on me. And we watched the Beach Nut, Saturday Night Beach Nut Hour.
Right.
Remember seeing Johnny Preston and Dion and the Belmonts and Conway Twitty. And then I was also like a TV kid, so I knew like every TV show. And if I see these guys now, maybe I didn't think of a guy's name in 100 years, and then they have a TV, there's a channel on now called MeTV, and in the wee hours, I'll watch Mr. Lucky or something.
Right.
And every guy's face I see, I know their name, and I go, oh my God, I haven't thought of this guy in over 50 years, but it's like your brain stores this information, and it's, you know, I don't know, what I have in my brain is a little dangerous, I think.
Well, you know, you get inside of things, which is good. Let me ask you some questions, too, because I want to get your, you know, just your reaction to certain things. I mean, I know you worked all those years with Kenny, and, of course, Kenny's a really talented guy. You know, when he broke away from the Americans, a lot of people don't understand how many things he touched. And, you know, when you turn around and, you know, people come to see the Planetones, it's like a religion. So, you know, and a lot of people, you know, now that Kenny has canceled a couple of shows, there were people that saying, I don't want to listen to Doo-Wop anymore because, you know, Kenny's not at the show. And, you know, what's really funny is that I, emceed Albanese's, my group, Harmony Street, was the first group ever to do a show for Albanese, you know, back at Queens College many, many years ago. We were the first group ever to hit a stage for him. So he remembered that. So he called me a couple of months ago and he says, I want you to emcee my Florida shows. I did one, Kenny and the Planetones, of course, closing the show. And then, of course, Kenny, you know, called and said, you know, we're not doing the show. And so they hired the Tokens, and then what happens? Jay Traynor passes away like 3 days before the show, and Frenchie, of course, sang, you know, filled in with the Tokens. But that was very tough to emcee that show because there was no Kenny, there was no Jay Traynor. I even had to sing 5 songs. So, you know, hey, it was good for me, but it was like, hey, man, you know, the Planetones have become a religion. And believe it or not, and this is, you know, me talking, here's a group that never had a hit, but is right at the top of the heap. And I'm going to point to Johnny Gale, and I'm going to say, Kenny's got a great false. He's a great singer. He spins a great yarn when, you know, and he's like a troubadour. But the secret to the Planetones, I've always thought, sitting in the audience and standing behind stage, was Johnny Gale. So that's my opinion.
Well, I'm so embarrassed now, but thank you.
Well, you know, because, you know, being musical, you know, and whatever, and watching, as I said, when I listen to stuff that you've produced, everything is, there is nothing on a production that doesn't belong there. Every note belongs there, and it's all in the right place. And I also noticed with your productions, your final mixes are like right in your face. You don't have to search for anything. Because I listened to a lot of the tunes that you sent me, and I said, okay, it's right there in your face. And I think you do that for a reason. It's everything is just is like hugging 0 dB, and it's right in your face. So am
when I'm making a record. It's just a different discipline, I guess, than performing. There's certain things that are universal with both, but it's like I really never leave a moment unaccounted for, you know.
Right.
And I have some other artists maybe I could mention that I've produced.
Well, you know, I actually want to go through some of that stuff like one by one. I have a friend, his name is Dennis Daugherty Sr.
Right.
And he told me a while ago that you were going to produce his son.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I finally got the CD in my hands and I listened to it through once, and then I had to listen to the whole CD through two more times. And I just stopped and I even, you know, reversed it and went back and listened to certain parts over and over in certain tunes. And I'm saying to myself, here's a kid that's a pretty good singer. But man, the word that comes to mind, and I said that to him because I interviewed him and we talked about you, is that it was so damn authentic. Tell me about that CD in your own words.
Well, Dennis Sr. was a friend for many years,
right.
And he had been recording someplace I won't mention.
Right.
And he called me and he was in distress and he said, I've been working for 3.5 years and I don't know if I have anything. So I told him to send me stems or whatever he had, MP3s, and I would see what he had and then I would, you know, give him an assessment. So I heard it and I said, it might be some things that I can redo or try to augment, but I said, it's probably best that I just, you know, recut a bunch of things. So, I went in and over the course of time, they picked, I think most of the songs, I may have picked one or two, but they just picked songs that they liked. And I did, it was a minimalist approach to arranging because, we weren't bringing in a big horn section or, it was basically like a guitar intensive kind of thing. And,
right.
And we worked in, like I said, with this technology now, it enabled me to be able to make what you hear there, and I got a lot of those ambient sounds artificially on that, you know,
right.
Because we record in a friend of mine has a basement recording studio. He's got a very good studio, but
right.
So it's just like I dial it in or I'll audition different sounds until I hear something that feels right to me, like so that sonic landscape is kind of feeling like, you know, that there's like some smiles in the room.
Right.
And I have recorded a bunch of other things with Dennis that haven't been, you know, we're still actually in progress on some stuff, and it just keeps getting better with him. So,
right.
They wanted me to write with Dennis, but it's I'm actually, you know, like juggling a bunch of things now, so that,
right.
that's a little different, the writing venue, you know.
But I mean, you know, first of all, Dennis really, really copped some pretty good vocals on that CD.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just a great CD. What are your favorite tunes from that CD?
Of course, he does an unbelievable Elvis. So.
Yes, he does.
And I channeled the Jordanaires on that, so.
Treat me like a fool. Treat me mean and cruel, but love me. Break my faithful heart. Tear it all apart, but love me.
Won't you love me?
Well, if you ever go, darling, I'd be oh so lonely. I'll be sad and blue, crying over. I would beg and steal,
beg and steal,
just
to feel
your heart.
I want your heart
beating close to Well, if you ever go, darling, I'd be oh so lonely. I'll be sad and blue, crying over you, dear only. I would beg and steal.
He would beg and steal.
Just to feel.
Just to feel.
Your heart.
I want your heart.
Beating close to mine.
So close to mine.
Well, if you ever go, darling, I'd be oh so lonely. Begging on my knees, all I ask is please, please love me. Oh yeah.
Necessity is the mother of invention. I'll do a background like the Paragons. I recorded Twilight with Kenny, and I became those like knife wielding little guys. And I'm Dennis's thing. I became the Jordanaires. But
I think Sincerely was on there. I think
Sincerely is really good.
Bop, bottle, bottle, bottle.
Never, never let you go.
he's a killer. Bring It On Home to me, we did with Eugene Pitt doing a duet, did the Lou Rawls part on it. And
I knew Gene since Herkimer Street in Brooklyn.
Gene is a legend for sure. And if you want this love of mine, I didn't know the song. They brought it with a Sunny Night song, who I love. I love Sunny Night, but I didn't know that song. And I found out that Sammy Davis Jr. had covered it. And so we made an interesting record on that. I love Darling Forever. I always loved that track.
Oh, yeah.
Darling, forever, forever, you can break my heart, take my love if you want to, but I'll play the part of a fool just to be with you forever. Darling, forever, forever, you can torment me, take my love if you want to, but I'll always be just a fool,
just a fool,
just to be with you forever. your slave for the rest of my days. Love you more in so, so many ways. Just to be with you thrills me through and through. And darling, forever, forever, you can break my heart, take my love if you want to, but I'll play the part of a fool,
just a fool,
just to be with you for. Darling, forever, forever.
Well, you know, what's really funny is that the now lead singer of that group is is Kenny Brady. And I do a show with him. He owns the trademark, as a matter of fact. I haven't played him that cut. He's going to love that cut. He and I do a show called Doo-Wop Stylings by Mike Miller and Ken Brady. And he owns the Casino's trademark, and he actually, you know, he took over the, he was an original Casino, but he took over the lead for Gene Hughes when Gene Hughes died. And, it's interesting. When I heard that tune, I says, oh, you know, I gotta play it for Kenny. I haven't done that yet. He'll love that.
Kiss me each morning for a million. Hold me each evening at your side. Tell me you love me for a million years. If it don't work out, if it don't work out, then you can tell me goodbye. Sweeten my coffee with a morning kiss. Soften my dreams with your sigh. Tell me you love me for a million years. Then if it don't work out, if it don't work out, then you can tell me goodbye. Must go. I won't tell you no, just so that we can say we tried. Tell me you love me for a million years. If it don't work out, if it don't work out, then you can tell me
goodbye. Well, you know, when I remember when that record was out, it was like a kind of anachronistic record in that moment in time.
Right.
I remember exactly what I was doing. I was on a mission to get a Fender Jazzmaster.
Yeah.
So, for your listeners that don't know what that is, it's a Fender guitar that was very popular at that, you know, at that time, like, 1967,
right.
66. So, I went out a couple of weekends with my father, the Bylines, and we found a guy in Long Beach. But I remember the guitar with all the chrome was really pitted, I guess, because, like, being on the beach was a little bit of an inhospitable environment for an instrument.
Right.
And the guy was going into the service at the time. So I ended up, my father said, oh, no, it was too ratty or whatever. Of course, it would, you know, be very cool if I now. But so, but I remember, you know, that record was getting a lot of airplay right in that moment. And I remember, like, you know, Bill Dylan and Rondell's May I, there was certain
records.
But they were anachronistic records. They were throwback records to an earlier time in that time, you know.
Right.
And because at that time the Beatles were huge, you know, and the Fifth Dimension, and it was just, you know, and that was so. Of course, I was a sucker for that sound. I heard that, and it just, you know, it was calling my name, you know, just the overall vibe of the record, you know.
That's funny. You know, I have a Fender Jaguar story. You know, when I was a kid, you know, I was living in Manhasset, and, you know, in those days, my friends and their fathers all made Jerry Ash rich, because Jerry had the store in Hempstead, and his wife Bernice used to sit at the cash register, and they were young 20s, you know. And I bought my father bought me a Fender Jaguar. It was stolen out of my 65 GTO, you know, yada, yada, yada. And then I bought and then CBS took over Fender. I bought a post CBS Fender Jaguar, and it was not the same guitar.
No, I know, you know, when I didn't get that, the next weekend we went to 48th Street. I went to Jimmy's, you know, because he was authorized Fender guy.
Yep.
And he didn't have anything, so we went to Ben's. You remember Ben's?
Yep, I do.
He didn't have a Jazz, but he had a Jaguar, right? And it was like Carl Wilson's Jaguar.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't thrilled to get it because the white matching headstock thing was not thrilling to me at that moment, but, you know, it was a professional guitar, and, you know, it was not my first choice. I remember I brought it home and my aunt was there. My aunt's husband was my uncle that was in the New York Philharmonic, and she saw it and she was intrigued by this, like, machine that I brought. There was so much chrome on that thing, you know. And I grew to really love it, and it was a smaller scale neck, you know, and I still have two in my collection, you know.
Wow.
A 64 and a 65.
Wow, believe it or not, I have a custom Legend, which I did not like, and I, you know, because I lived in Connecticut, I brought it back to them, and, you know, I happened to get, Tom Hamilton was a vice president there, and he invited me to a board meeting, and they all passed the guitar around, and John Budney was the head of, you know, customer service then. He says, I don't like it either. He says, we're going to make you one. And they did. They made me one. They walked it through production, whatever. I still have it. It's fabulous. And I have an Adamas, but, you know, a lot of people don't like Ovation, but I use it to record with. And my other guitar, I only have one other guitar now. It's a 50th anniversary Strat, and I played on about 15 of them before I bought this one, and I like it. You know, it's good.
That's great. I had Grover Jackson, you know, Jackson guitars. I had 20 years ago, I had a solo album out, and I had some endorsements. I had a non-exclusive deal with Gibson because I couldn't give up my Strat, you know, so I signed on for 18 months with them, and I had a deal with Washburn and some other amps and Laney amps and strings, and so Grover Jackson built me a Strat-type guitar, and he never did a finish in nitrocellulose.
Uh-huh.
It took like a year. He had it under his workbench, you know, because it took forever to cure.
Right.
And I got it was, you know, to my specs, light as a feather. The neck was my specs, and I never really used it. It's just sitting, you know, upstairs in my attic. But And there was another guy recently, he has a guitar line, and he had a Les Paul type guitar that he calls the Gale.
Right.
And he sent me one, and the thing was like a boat anchor, you know, so couldn't really play that, but I thought it was sweet, you know.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the projects that you've done that are really near and dear to your heart. Tell me about Ryan Shaw.
Well, I got involved with a group called the Soul Shakers through their manager. He knew me from, the Planetones, and I guess he knew that I had some pretty good grip on, you know, the doo-wop R&B thing. So I went down to see them, and Jerry Jamont was playing bass, and Lonnie Youngberg was playing sax. And ironically, some of those guys really didn't have an interest in that music or a great feel for it, but it was really cool show business. They had a guy that was an MC. It was really a throwback to, you know, to another time. And I said, yeah, I'll hang with this for a minute, and I ended up becoming their arranger and musical director. And
right.
So Ryan wasn't with them for maybe the first year or two that I was, you know, doing some gigs with him on the side, and he showed up, and I remember we did a couple of things in the show that just the guy's intensity blew me away. The guy was incendiary, you know, and uh-huh. And he was like a really, I thought he was like, you know, 17 years old. He was a little older, but
right.
He was very quiet. So I had a buddy of mine named Jimmy Breilauer that is in the record business. He's been, you know, in the record business for many years, and he lives nearby, and I've done a lot of work with him. And I told him, we had actually started cutting some tracks, because he worked at Atlantic for like 4 years, and then uh-huh. he was out of that, and then he called me and he said, you're the only guy that never called me at Atlantic. Everybody else was calling me to exploit the fact that I was a VP up there.
Right.
I never did. So we started cutting some tracks, and I think the first thing we cut was What Does It Take to Win Your Love for Me, the Junior Walker
right.
Fuqua thing. So liked it, and so I said, I have this young guy I work with. I said, you should come down. We're playing at this place called Pianos in the Village.
Right.
He came down, and we, you know, it was like the floating membership in the group. I think that night I had Steve Gabori playing keyboard. He's like Cyndi Lauper's guy, and some good people, and I would rehearse them. And so we heard Ryan, you know, he flipped, and then we invited him to come to his house, and we said, we'll make a couple of demos, and we did. I Found a Love, you know, Falcons, and I Do the Jerk, and I think we maybe did three songs, and, you know, we were excited. He seemed like, you know, he was into it, so we basically, you know, made a record in the spare time that none of us really had, and then Jimmy had, you know, some hookups in the business, and we got whatever we had. They liked it at Columbia, so he got him a deal on Columbia, and then he got a lot of TV appearances, and the record ended up the A&R person that signed him, whose name escapes me right now.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember 2007 as well as like 1957.
Right.
He lost his gig there, and he went to a company called Razor and Tie. They were a very big independent label. So he took Ryan with him, and Ryan, they put the record out on that label. Anyway, there was a song we covered, this song by Asher and Simpson called I Am Your Man.
Uh-huh.
And it was done, I think, by Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers, and it wasn't a hit, you know, or maybe it was a minor hit. And Ryan got a Grammy nomination for the record. It was a record we made. I had so much orchestration on it. Just at 3 o'clock in the morning, I walked out of Jimmy's basement and created an orchestra.
Rely on me to supply your needs from now on. Shelter you and be a pillar to lean on. For in your eyes I see what I was born to be. And now my life can begin. For I am your man. Oh, yes I am, yes I am. I'm your man. There's no sacrifice, great or small, I wouldn't do. See, my ambition is bringing happiness to you. And if trouble comes our way, I won't run, I promise to stay. My
has had, subsequently, he's had two other Grammy nominations for two other records that we made for him.
Wow.
So the one this year for a rearrangement of Yesterday by the Beatles.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday. All my troubles seem so far away. Now I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly, I ain't half the man I used to be.
Most people don't understand that when you go in and you record everything that has to be recorded, that you have an even bigger job ahead of you, and that's, you know, to go in there and mix it so that it's, you know, palatable and deliverable, you know, to the people that are going to listen to it. And, I mean, I can remember spending hours and hours and hours and watching really big-time engineers spend hours and hours and hours and then come back in the morning and say, what was I thinking?
No, I know it's a whole process. And right. The real process begins when when it's finished and you begin to promote the record.
So
that's a whole trip. I just have a thing now that I was involved with a guy named Mark Rivera.
Uh-huh.
I've been with Billy Joel for many years, and he's right. Ringo Starr's musical director. So I have a couple of co-writes on it. I wasn't as involved in his record as I was with Ryan Shore, which just, you know, well, the team was, it was me, Jimmy Brelauer, and Ryan.
Right.
And, they have the record out now, and he's starting to do some gigs, and I'm actually doing some freelancing with him.
Wow.
And, well, so we're kind of excited about that now.
You know, I hung out in Long Island when I was a kid at the Cloud Nine, and, you know, the OBIs and Rum Bottoms and, you know, all the Action House and all of those clubs. I saw everybody pass through, and we spoke about that, you know, Illusion and Leslie and Larry West and, you know, the whole Long Island contingent. But I remember Richie Cannata and Liberty DeVito and all those guys. Liberty DeVito had a trio called Blue Hair.
Uh-huh.
They used to play at the Camelot Inn in Mineola. And
Noah Well, I used to play there too.
Yeah, and they used to do like a 40-minute Chicago medley, three guys. And I'm telling you, you walked in and the room was full of music. There were three guys singing and they played so much music. It was just a guitar and a bass and drums, man. And they just rocked the house, three guys.
Well, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I used to be with Randy and the Rainbows, but
right.
We were a rock band and we called ourselves Them and Us at the time. And
right.
We would our routine was, you know, we played some, we did 300 jobs a year.
Right.
Mostly one-nighters.
A lot.
We had a storefront. We had a storefront on Elliott Avenue in Middle Village when I joined, and then moved to Ozone Park, and we were on Liberty Avenue. But we would bring in, carry around a Hammond B-3-2 Leslie.
Uh-huh.
And because I was, like, the biggest, strongest guy in the group, that was always, like, I was always, So I remember, like, you know, rehearsing. I would have to learn stuff that I never would listen to,
right.
but it was popular. So I remember having to deconstruct, like, Dialogue Part 2 by Chicago. And I guess in the process of deconstructing, like, so many songs to be able to play them, and I would assign parts to guys, and I would teach them, you know, a bass part or a vocal part, although with that group, Dominic was kind of in charge because it was too big of a job. We had a 7-piece group. He would work with the singers, which was his brother Frank and
right.
Zero.
Know them well, yeah.
And I would work with the musicians, and we would do, you know, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Three Dog Night, and Chicago, and Derek and the Dominoes. I brought some stuff in that was nice, and they liked it. I used to do Bell Bottom Blues, and I would play like a weepy guitar on it, and we had a lot of gigs. We were like compressed time. You know, in 3 years, we did 1,000 jobs, and it was just like, it was like 30 years. And we did so much, spent so much time together. In those days, we had no accommodations. You know, you go out. And we'd be like someplace in Warren, Vermont in the dead of winter, and they put us in a room in the back of the place with no electricity. fortunately, I've come a little bit of a
well, you get to know all. You get to know where all the diners are. I'll tell you that, man.
For sure.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Randy Sofuto of Randy and the Rainbows, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show. Mike, love you.
Love you too, man. It's funny. I used to play guitar through a Leslie when we were playing. We used to play a place called St. James Infirmary in Deer Park.
Oh, well, in
Deer Park.
Right.
And Little Barry used to own the place. Little Barry Laney was a midget.
We used to play there, when the Cleft Tones would be there.
Yeah, exactly. And I used to play guitar through a Leslie in those days, and people would say, wow. And, you know, but I played rhythm guitar, but of course, you know, you had to strum differently, but it would ring. The other thing I do is, you know, I do a lot of guitar MIDI, and I do a lot of strings and horns, you know, with my guitar MIDI, because that's really my axe. I'm not a great keyboard player, you know. So, and it's interesting because I've done some stuff and people say to me, you did that with a guitar? I go, yeah, but you got to think differently.
Well, for sure.
You know, you can't think like,
if you're doing a string arrangement, you know, you kind of either have to have a feel for it or have studied it.
Right.
I have all that, I type in all that stuff. We call it typing it in programming, you know, drums, inflections.
Right.
You're doing strings to make it sound like, you know, maybe a human in the room.
Right.
And, one thing I really can't do, is I can maybe augment horn sections, but I have a couple of guys I'll call, and then we'll stack some of the guys, bring in a Barry and a tenor and a trumpet player, and we do whatever it takes to be able to try to, you know, hear, you know, the sound that we want to hear at the end of the day.
Right. You know? No, I hear you. I had one time, I have a ballad called Harmony Street, and it's been on so many compilations, and people have wanted to use it for movies and, you know, this and that. You know, I never really got it into a big movie, but the point is, I had a sax solo at the beginning. I'll send you the tune. I had a sax solo at the beginning, And the guy who played sax, he was a guy by the name of Charlie Yacuzzi. He was on a lot of albums during the 50s and everything. But I couldn't get the sound I wanted. We were using all of these expensive mics. And then finally I said, you know what? And I grabbed the SM58 and I put it down and he played the part and I said, that's it. Got mm-hmm. it. It had to do with the microphone, not with the sax.
Yep.
You know, because playing it through the SM58, that was the sound. I mean, you're playing it through like a $2,000 microphone. I didn't like it.
You know, there's all those factors. I guess it's like we all carry around that sounds in our heads you know, you hear something and you know, I guess if you get the more sophisticated you get, the more experience you have at troubleshooting that or analyzing and diagnosing
right.
it, then you figure out, you know, it kind of tells you what it needs and then you chase it, you know.
How was it working with Cyndi Lauper?
You know, great. I knew Cyndi, like she was actually a fan in the 70s. I played in rock bands and she'd be in the audience and she'd be saying, do it, Johnny.
Yeah, I love her. She's
And then I actually was dating her for a while.
Cool, man.
She lived in Woodhaven and when she had the band Blue Angel, I remember I was in a diner on Queens Boulevard and she yells out across the diner, I didn't know she was there, it's Johnny Gale. And so she came over and she said, I have this band, you know, we're great, but no one will hire us. So I got her a gig from Phil Basile. It was, you know, at the Action House of Speaks at the time.
I remember.
So they opened up, because I remember she did lipstick on your collar, lipstick, man. and they were great. And of course, you know, she then at that point blew up. But many years later, I played with her at Carnegie Hall. And she asked me to sing a duet part with her, and I did. After the gig, I had like a little party, and I was down there, and Donald Fagen was there, So she took me over the side, and she said, "I never forgot that when no one would touch me, no one would help me, that you got me gigs." You know,
wow.
And I didn't even remember really, but I just. I guess I'm a kind person, so I just thought she was a deserving person of to be able to, you know, be seen. And the ironic thing is they opened up for us, and after she got done, I said, oh, my God, you know, we can't follow her. She was dynamite.
Right.
And we were like, you know, like a bunch of chooches, you know. So can we talk about the Soul Survivors?
Absolutely. We can talk about anything you want to talk about because this is about you. It's about you, John.
Okay, so I Charlie and Richie Ingwe, you know, good friends of mine,
right?
Them for many years, and we Jimmy and I had some tracks that I thought, you know, these guys, you know, deserve to have a record, and we have some tracks, so we had a few things, and then over a course of maybe 2 years, because it was in, you know, we had, you know, it was almost impossible, and also logistically, Charlie lives in Annapolis, Maryland, and Richie lives far away, but somehow they were troopers. They came around, and it's like, you know, not like people envision you're in a studio and there's an ensemble there. It's not that. It's like me sitting there with a technician, and it's just different than people envision it, I think, or most people.
Right.
So they came in, and we, you know, got their vocals and made what I thought was a terrific record on them. We were hoping that, you know, it would be out there and that it would help them and show, you know, people how great those guys are. And we still are, you know, we're still trying to work it. So, because there's no real expiration date on that stuff. But,
right.
We had a pretty good effort there. And there's some high recognition covers of some stuff. And then there's some more esoteric stuff on there. We did a thing called Soulful Love that was an Impressions tune that is, you know, not so well known. And we did some stuff on there that is very well known. So.
I try hard and do my best to bring about words to express, to show you how much I appreciate your soothing tenderness. But who can define soulful love? How have to say just takes me further away. The most sincere thing on my mind, I could never unwind. But who can define soulful love? How in your mind can you find a way to say you got soulful love?
Start to finish everything that you sent me, and it is, after listening to all of the tunes, there's Johnny Gale all over it. You have a certain approach to the way you do things, and it's distinctive.
To me. I think I just have, a certain sensibility, and it's just, when it's in front of me, it has my attention, and I just, be me, and just hope for the best, and some of them, come out and they were delight. And other ones, I said, well, I hoped for it to, be something else. But I've gotten pretty consistent at making pretty good records, I think. But, it's just a peculiar time now because I love making records. And right now, it's unfortunate. Record making has become so devalued because of
as
soon as you can put a disc in a computer, it changed the landscape.
Well, the whole business has changed. I mean, let's put it this way. Every 16-year-old kid has Pro Tools in his house, and he's making records that are as sophisticated as a whole room of equipment 40 years ago.
Right.
And the ones that are good at it are good at it, but there's so much product coming, and nobody knows what to do with the record. I've spoken to some of the guys. Give you an example. Mel Carter, who Hold Me, Thrill Me, Kiss Me, he's recording every week, man. He's always in the studio putting new stuff down. His neighbor and his friend, who lives, in California, not far from him, Lenny Welch, has said, damn, I'm not making another record ever in my life, man. I wouldn't know what to do with it. I just want to do my shows, sing my hits, and that's it. because right. nobody knows what to do with the record anymore. Right. And, you know, it's a different business, you know, totally different business. It's crazy, actually.
but, I mean, you know, making records, it really has to be a calling now, you know.
Because the whole thing is about being creative. And you know, if you continue to be creative, I know because I know you, if you had to stop being creative, you would shrivel up.
Absolutely. But it also, you know, a big aspect of it is having rabbinical patience because... it really is. I mean, it's not a sport for like the faint of heart. You know, it really isn't. And people just don't know. You know what it takes. You know, unless you do it. If that's what you do and you're in that business, you make records, and only those people really know what it takes. You know, to go from start to across the finish line. You know.
Right.
But I always tell people that the rock and roll idiom. Was all about the tough and tender rub, you know,
uh-huh.
like Phil Spector records, and it was about juxtaposing, you know, tender melody that could be what somebody might consider corny, with like a sock backbeat, like tough, prominent backbeat. It's that rub of tender and tough that like pulled me in. In a big way, you know, at a tender age, you know.
Right.
I probably wasn't as analytical about it as I was a little later on, but so that, the whole rock and roll, the doo-wop rock and roll thing was kind of about that for me, you know. And I wasn't a straight, you know, adult-oriented pop records from the... I'm into Italian music, you know, like right. 50s Italian music. I'm into the 50s country music, like, you know, like Furlet Husky and Sonny James and Eddie Arnold. If it's like something that is, it feels real and the sound is otherworldly, and I'm with it, you know. I have like such vivid memories of, and they got duller as I got older, you know. And also like when we got into the early 70s with changing, the way records were made,
right?
The technology really changed, and that I started to like lose interest in it. There's not that many things that I could put on that blow me away. I did like one song, "Tie the Toe on the Line," Rocky Burnett, Johnny Burnett's son.
Right.
A record like, you know, it's, you know, straight up doo wop, but in that era, I was really not with the sounds sonically, you know, But, you know, if you go back a few years, even to the mid-60s, I guess the last vestige of what I call, like, you know, the greasy sound, like, you know, Barbara Mason, Yes, I'm Ready. There's so much depth to the record. It just would grab a hold of me, and I'd be paralyzed to it, you know. Some records that were, you know, really depressing, and other ones that were incredibly stimulating, you know, here... I remember when the British invasion hit, I would, you know, be pumped up. I was jacked up because I wanted to be in the Dave Clark Five, you know.
Ah.
I get that militaristic, it just was appealing to me, you know, in that moment.
Well, are different rooms that you can enter as you go. You've been involved in a lot of commercials too, John.
Yeah, not so much recently, but in the 90s I was.
Uh-huh. Which is interesting too. I mean, that's like a totally different approach to things. You got to get it all in there in a short period of time. Say what you got to say and get in and get out.
I'll tell you what, it wasn't short. There were layers to that.
Yeah.
I had a manager. I've had many managers, but I remember the guy calling. Kept calling this jingle. I worked for the Giants in the jingle industry,
uh-huh.
And he kept calling, and he said, "What are you?" And he was a musician. He was, you know, in a rock band that they, you know, he knew about the recording studio. I said, it's like doing music for a movie. It was so many layers to it.
Wow.
And, but I got discovered doing that because I played a show at the Bottom Line with David Foreman before we had Little Isidore.
Right.
And, we had the same manager. And, there was another artist that the manager had named Andrew Fortier. And I had co-written a song called I Say Grace with Andy.
Right.
And David heard it and, he needed to meet me because he heard my chords or something. So he heard some, and really it was like a quasi-sacred kind of Chuck Jackson-esque kind of thing, but we got together, and he had an act, and but we had written a couple of songs, and we included them in this show. And he turned around, he looked at me, and he said, "We just have to do that." But there were all these, he was in the jingle business, and there were all the jingle people in the audience, and they saw me, they liked the way I played, and I guess they liked the way I looked, so I got bombarded, and then all of a sudden, the next day, I was thrust into that world, and I worked in that for a few years, and had some success in that, you know, had a couple of things that were pretty big.
No, that's cool, man, you know, because you get to, like, ring all the bells, you know, it's like, that's just another corner of the room. Tell me about the Gale Force album.
I had a friend that was a fan, that was a little younger than me, that said, I need to capture whatever you're doing. He would our sound man, and I would do boom, boom, you know, like the Animals, the way they did it.
Right.
Every night. So this is crazy. I got to get you in the studio. So he financed on his credit card me going in, and we went to the power station.
Oh, know it well.
Steve Boyer engineered. Steve, you know, went crazy.
That was Tony Bon Jovi.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it's now Avatar. But, so we went in, I cut a bunch of tracks, and we had like a cassette tape floating around, and it went, you know, everybody loved it, and I remember I had a hookup with Jimmy Iovine, Interscope Records.
Right.
Thing, and he wanted to put me on his roster, and I had a manager at the time, who I won't mention, who just didn't close that deal, and then
right.
The Gulf broke out, and then that went away. So I ended up on this guitar label, which was distributed by Relativity.
Mm-hmm.
It was just such a mishmash of, I gave them about 24 tracks I had, and they picked the ones that they liked. And,
right.
And, so there was a singer that I had originally that had pulled out. He didn't want to be on the record because he was a little neurotic, and a really great singer too. So in those days, I didn't do TV mixes, so I had to go in and remix everything. It cost me a lot of money to whatever you have there with that record, but they put it out, and it got like some big airplane. The Southwest, they loved it, and they had over 90 stations, so it's called Going Breaker. Mostly P3s and 4s, which were little mom and pop stations, but we had a couple of P2s.
Right.
And I went out to Anaheim for the NAMM show in January of 74. It's when the record was released, and their label director told me that she quit, and the label was folded. So,
yeah.
But their radio promotions guy was still on, and he was still, you know, pushing it. And everything is timing. You know, had I had it out a quarter earlier, it might have been a different outcome, because they had Brad Gillis on their label, uh-huh. And he had some kind of minor hit, like 6 months earlier. But I got a lot of promotion through their. They were really a publishing company. And they had a lot of print ads on me, and I had endorsements, and I was like a bona fide rock guy. And it's kind of like a blues rock record, but there's some interesting things on there, you know. And Dion got a copy of it, and he said to me, "You couldn't do anything with this record." He said, "I'm never making a record again, then." You know.
Mike, this is Dion. Stay well. God bless.
It's sweet, you know, but. It was over a period, I think, from around 1988 to 1993, those 5 years, on and off, whenever I could. It was like, I couldn't tell you how uncivilized it was all done. The power station was civilized, but then doing overdubs and that stuff, you know, where we were was, you know, unbelievable. And it was all part of my learning experience and my journey, you know, So I don't regret it. And today there's a couple of things on there. There were, I think, two mixes that were casualties on there, unfortunately,
right.
but and they were pretty good tracks. But and then there's some other ones on there that are fantastic. So, you know, the energy is really.
and your long, long legged daddy. No, that napper ain't getting up no time too soon. So, well, Uncle Napper, sleep back, yeah. I'm gonna be creeping upstairs into your. Baby, into your love.
Thank you. for you if you want me to. I really don't believe that your love is true. When I fall down, almost level with the ground. When I feel like this, when my baby ain't been found.
Well, it's like everything else. And also, you got to go from here to there to there to there to there in order to get to here. And yeah, as long as you keep staying creative, I'm going to ask you a question that is probably, I need to ask you. Here's Johnny Gale spending a great block of time working with the Planetones. And I know that Kenny was probably booked all the way into, you know, 2017. And as far as the public is concerned, it's a big question mark. I don't know who really knows the answer to it. But now all of a sudden, here's Johnny Gale, you know, with a lot of time to fill. And you guys were working like crazy.
I tell you, Mike, I'm busier now because freelancing is, you know, 10,000 times the work of having a bread and butter job. I cultivated that job with Kenny for that reason, so I wouldn't have to freelance. But now I'm freelancing. I'm working with very good people.
Right.
The honest answer is that none of us know.
The whole sound was the less is more sound. You know what I mean? It was like, how can I explain it? It wasn't, none of it was overdone. You know, a lot of groups get up there and everything's overdone.
You know what, Mike? It's like we're very arranged by me.
Right.
I always tell the guys that it's like dynamics, like that professional dynamics. It's like the guy that yells all the time. You know, people first, they come out and they're kind of, they are stunned maybe, or they're like a little jarred. And then they acclimate to the yelling, and then it becomes just inane, like a drone, as opposed to the guy that speaks softly, and when he raises his voice,
right,
you know, it has more impact. Then I have this two-dog scenario I tell people about, performers, you know, about being overly giving or, you know, too out there.
Right.
It's like, you go to a guy's house, he has two big dogs, go to the door, they open the door, one guy pounces on you, and he's drooling all over you,
right,
and the other guy's, and, you know, off to the side, doesn't really want to have anything to do with you.
Uh-huh.
Which guy do you want to pet?
Right.
You know, so just as a metaphor, you know, for certain, like, you know, I've been dealing with performers and singers for so many years that it's all part of the process of, you know, put something on stage and to have 40 minutes that really works.
Right.
You know, 10 years, you know, to do that. So it's, you know, quite the thought now of cultivating something from scratch is, you know, is too big for me to even think about. That's why we developed this Up Close and Personal show that we do
right,
on our own, because
right,
there would be people out there that it would be like a house band, no arrangements. They'd be playing, it would sound like the Ramones backing up Freddie Canada.
I know.
This was not right. And you know, I know for me, I want to hear the arrangements from the records. And if it's something was a hit record, you know, in all likelihood, there was probably some pretty good brain trust in the room when they made it, and they had an arrangement. You kind of want to hear that.
Yeah.
It would be like a guy going up and singing a song and changing the melody completely. Well, in the old days, you know, I got a pickup there, and, you know, I would tell the drummers to touch it, you know, because it would just, we'd be better off with just my guitar and the singers.
Right.
You know, it would be like, I'd be like Abdul from The Drifters, you know.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
And it's just frustrating because I a lot of those shows I can't tolerate because I have like so much love for those records and so much respect that if I hear them being done disrespectfully, for musicians, I know them and they have disdain for that music.
Right.
And it's just that they happen to be in that field. I can't get with that. You know, a lot of them can't. They think that they don't. They think I'm good. They don't understand me.
Right.
and they think, oh, the guy, you know, sounds like maybe he's got like an uncanny knack of playing this music, and I don't. You know, it's I have spent thousands of hours, you know, on my own when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, deconstructing the records, wanted to get inside every record, wanted to figure out how they got the sounds they got, how they, you know, like how piano chords played against a guitar chord, you know, how to do cross tones and voicing chords and registers to be in, you know, in relation to where the melody is, all those things, and then dynamics, you know, playing down to a whisper, being like a minimalist, and because definitely when you get in, especially in big venues, less is definitely more. We have arrangements, so a lot of times I'll just play bass parts on the guitar because we're big in the vocals. So it's just kind of having a part that stays out of the way to keep the focus there, and you know, not leaving a stone unturned, you know, and paying attention to every moment.
Well, it shows. I mean, you know, it's, I can't tell you how many shows you go to and these guys don't know how to play behind vocalists, and you don't even, I mean, and drummers. I was lucky. I played in a couple, you know, I was with a couple of groups where the drummers were so good that they would actually give you that little diddlip before you come in with the first verse. And the drummers were so hep. They take you up on the bridge. They take you down on the verse. And, you know, it's like, but then you get guys that just crash through the whole thing. And, you know, bass players and drummers, man. They kill these doo-wop groups. I mean,
the power, and the keyboard players with their left hand bass, they got the power. It's, you know what I found, Mike, is just, it's something that I've noticed, is that wrong has a tendency to be real strong and has a way of taking over.
Yeah.
And when that happens, if I get thrown into, say, I end up, you know, being at a show and I'm part of a backing group, you know, Jay Siegel used to tell me, I love to work with you. And I would tell him, I'm only as good as the weakest guy you have up there. I can't make it any better because those guys take control. They plow through the stuff and they play loud and they play at one level.
Yes.
They play in the wrong registers. Bass players playing. I mean, they should play like you're on a bull fiddle. You know, take the low E string off the thing.
Right, right.
And also that the values of the notes, the hang time on the notes, it's all that stuff. You get in a place, it becomes like ponderous, and so it's like a lot of times I'm, you know, working against the sound guy, you know, and if I don't have the cooperation of the people that I work with, and, you know, I just happen to, these guys know that they make money with me, so, you know, they've been winning with me, so, you know, most of the time they're cooperative, and the more cooperative everyone is, I'm not like a, you know, like a dictator or anything, but I'm analytical, and when we get in rehearsal mode, I sit, I listen, I flip parts around, I reconfigure things just to try to make it as good as it can be with the components that I have. Try to figure out what people's abilities are, what their disabilities are. Some guys are quick studies, some guys aren't. But, you know, putting together a group, I mean, most people, you know, that are like civilians, we call them, pedestrians,
right.
They have no idea. They say, well, why can't you just do this? And, of course, if you're like going through the complexities that life has a tendency to throw out, it could be like a little, you know, they're innocent and they don't mean anything, but it could be a little annoying, you know. Being a good listener is more important than anything.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And the singer has to overreach because a guy's playing too loud or he's got bad dynamics.
Right.
Then it blows your scene. I would decorate around the, I would play, you know, stuff like sprinkle fairy dust around the melody.
Right.
And I would never get in the way, and I would go in a very gentle way, you know. And then if I needed to be forceful, it would you know have impact because I wasn't, you know, full out, you know, on the whole gig, you know. So now it's painful for me to see people doing stuff wrong or hiring the wrong people. You know, it's painful.
But that's what you do.
Hey, listen, you know, and I still in the wee hours, I still listen to the same records I did when I was a kid. I'm staring at them now, you know, my 45s and my LPs, and now, you know, of course, I have my iTunes with 10,000 songs in there. And, I mean, it's like we got on the radio growing up, so I knew, like, Morgan by Ivo Robish and Mike Tillotson, but but, you know, then a little later on, in the mid-60s, I was messing around my father's shortwave and FM radio. There was nothing on there in those days. And I stumbled into a show called the Time Capsule Show.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, Fordham University station. And I started hearing some stuff that I loved. And I got a pen and a piece of paper, and I wrote down George Grant and the Castells, the Carter Rays, you know, some early Jerry Ragavoy produced stuff, mm-hmm. and I still have that list in my drawer, you know, from 1965. Wow. I have about 500 songs listed on there, and so I said, you know, so I loved what I heard on the radio, like the pop hits and like stuff that would be considered doo-wop, but was mixed in with Perry Como, or, you know, just a. I figured out, by the way, why they would put Perry Como in the rock and roll stations. I think it was every third or fourth song when the kids were in the car, they needed to calm the parents down, so they would put on something for them, you know.
But, that's funny.
And then Gus Gossard after that, you know, I got turned on to a couple of things like Long Tall Girl by the Carnations that drove me wild,
right.
You know. And I met Wayne Sterling, you know, and
oh, I did. I had a group called the Islanders. We did the Best of Acapella with Wayne and Eddie Grice. Believe it or not, out of Hackensack, and we had a couple of cuts on there when I was a kid. Oh yeah, yeah.
So and also like Jerry Green put out all these albums of Jerry Blavitt. So
yeah.
I bought all of them. I was, you know, 13, 14, 15
wow.
years old. I still have them.
Ooh, Papa Do, how do you do? My name is the Gator with the Heater, the big boss for the big hot sauce, Jerry Blavitt, and you know who you're listening to? My man, Mike Miller, ladies and gentlemen, the man who knows everything in the land with the music, the stories, and the sound on Harmony Street.
Those Jerry Blavitt records had stuff I never heard before. I guess regional stuff from Philly and maybe like the Atlantic area, you know.
Right.
And so I had that. And then years later, I got invited to participate with a guy named Ronnie I in his organization, UGA.
Yeah, I knew Ronnie very well. Yep.
And I started there in 1987. And very gently, I heard what he had in the band. It just, a lot of stuff wasn't right. But he didn't know me, so I didn't have the credibility to come in like heavy-handed and start changing up things. But over a period of years, I had an influence there. In making records, I implemented a procedural thing for them to help them make better records. And the live shows hired guys that played the idiom in a more authentic way.
Right. Well, Harmony Street opened up the 200th anniversary show, and I remember... Isidore was there that night. You were probably there that night too. That was the 200th anniversary show. There were about 23 groups showed up. They had the show. The Orioles closed the show. Harmony Street opened the show, and every group that showed up, every a cappella group, he put on. It was like 8 o'clock at night, and it went till 4:30 in the morning because groups kept showing up, and he kept putting them on.
Yeah, what year was it? Do you remember?
It had to be during the, I got to think real hard, probably 1990-something,
I was definitely there. Little Isidore was there.
Yes, David was there in the crowd. They didn't perform, but he was there in the crowd that night.
I'm sure I was there. I used to bring my son there when he was a little baby.
Yep.
Now, I did a lot of shows there. I mean, the list of people I played with is... You know, got to be a mile long, but we did some amazing shows that were historic. Was really educational and incredible. What an experience! And we had such a rich superculture in those days, where every region had its own sensibility. You know, out of New Orleans, it didn't sound like something that came out of Cincinnati or out of New York or L.A. Now, I mean, for years everything's so homogenized, it could be from anywhere. But you know, it was an unbelievable time. Before I played an instrument, I played a lot of records.
So, Johnny, I know that we probably don't have enough time to talk about all the things that we need to talk about, But I really, really appreciate you taking out time from your busy life to spend some time with me and getting to know the real Johnny Gale and, you know, how you think and taking me through your fabulous career. I really appreciate it.
Mike. Really great fun. And it's exciting.
I have always respected everything you've ever done, and I've listened to an awful lot of your work, and it's just some of the best in the business. So, you know, enough said about that.
I really am flattered, and I appreciate it.
Let's certainly stay in touch, and, you know, let me know what you're doing when you do it. I'll see you out there very, very soon. Have a great week, man, all right?
You too, Mike.
I'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good, Mike.
All right, thank you. Thank you, too.
Okay, thank you much.
Bye.
Twilight, 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 peeping through my window. Twilight, 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 peeping through my window.
Twilight.